Welcome to Shazam, the podcast that hopes to make itself obsolete. I'm your host, Kayla Drescher. We got Josephine freaking Lee. Enough said. And it begins in 3, 2, 1. Happy holidays, everyone. Happy holiday season, month, all of the above. I hope it's going really, really well. We had a little bit of a Hanukkah celebration night one and had some cool gifts. And then for Christmas, we are doing almost nothing. And I'm really, really excited. Our Christmas tradition is we order Chinese food, which is a very Jewish Christmas, according to Harrison. And then we watch White Christmas with Bing Crosby and Rosemary Clooney. So I'm really excited. I always get excited for that movie. It's honestly, I think it's the greatest Christmas movie, specifically for one sentence. And it's just glorious because this movie is from, I want to say the 50s. And there's a quote in there where one of the sisters says to the other about their brother, Benny got a job in Alaska. He's been out of the country for 3 months. And that is just the greatest thing I could ever ask for on Christmas, is that quote over and over again every single year. So I hope you get a chance to watch White Christmas. It's on Netflix. It's great. It definitely does not pass the Bechdel test, and I'm not mad about it. It's just a wonderful, joyous Christmas story. So I hope you have great holidays and you have good holiday plans, even though I hope they're safe and over Zoom, all of that. So stay very safe, please. Be cautious of, you know, the pandemic and the world that we're currently in. But have a great holiday season. So we are going to be off next week because of New Year's and holidays and things. It's just a lot easier. We're going to take the week off. I let everybody have a great holiday season and not worry about whatever's going on in the world of magic. And I'm going to do the same. So I'm really excited for that. And then we'll be back on January 4th for our regularly scheduled programming. Yay! So have a great holidays and all of the above. And without further ado, let's get into this week's episode. Josephine Lee. Josephine's fresh modern spin on magic took the magic world by storm after her appearance on Britain's Got Talent. This magic act hit millions of views overnight, making Josephine the most talked about woman in the magic industry. She has since made TV appearances all over the world. Her UK television credits include The Magicians, The One Show on BBC One, The Next Great Magician, and Britain's Got Talent. Her international television credits include the world famous Le Plus Grand Cabaret du Monde. I just butchered that, and I'm so sorry. You understand what, I hope you know the show. It's a great show. Cabaret du Monde, go watch it. And then there's another show, oh, I'm going to butcher it, Tu Sui Que Vales. I'm so sorry. I did my best to research how to pronounce these things, and it just didn't happen. Anyway, she's also been on Showdown of the World's Best Magicians, The Best of Got Talent 2018, and Diversion 2019 TF1. She has spent the last few years headlining in Impossible, which toured the world following two seasons in the heart of London's West End, and a second world tour as a headline act with The Illusionists, the smash hit show that broke records both in Broadway and the West End. Josephine spent 2019 on tour in China, performing in over 50 cities. Her passion for magic has given her the opportunity to perform for names such as Prince Albert of Monaco, Stella McCartney, and Jermaine Jackson, just to name a few. Josephine's work has taken her from the stage of London's West End to hundreds of European theaters and arenas all around the globe. No top hats and tailcoats, no rabbits out of hats, this is a modern spin on magic that has completely captured the industry. And you're about to hear why, so let's get to it. Welcome, Josephine Lee. Hi, Josephine.
Hi.
I like saying hi at the start of the episode, like we haven't been talking for 15 minutes.
Well, yeah. Longer. We've had a full-on chit-chat.
How are you doing in the middle of a pandemic?
I am still alive and healthy, and that is all that matters. So I keep saying.
That's fantastic.
If we make it through 2020, you have achieved something if you come out the other end alive. So we're good.
I don't know how it's been for you in terms of where you live, but we've had fire tornadoes. I didn't even know that was a thing.
I literally said the other day, if there was a zombie apocalypse, I would just be like, yeah.
Just of course. Natural progression.
Exactly.
I love it. So I first heard of you, which I'm sure a lot of people did, after BGT.
Yeah.
And then I did a pretty intense deep dive on who is Josephine Lee. And that was like 2 years ago. And it's awesome to finally talk to your face.
Amazing.
This is really exciting. So I want to start just the normal kind of annoying question of the before magic.
Yeah.
Who were you?
Before magic, I was a dancer. I was trained in ballet from the age of 3 and danced my entire life until I found myself dancing in a magic show for Hans Klock. And then naturally, I transitioned from dancing to magic.
Naturally. I like that that's obviously, that's just obviously. Where someone
where
goes.
Else is gonna go?
That's a good point. How did you end up getting in Hans Klock's show?
So there was a lady who lives in Vegas, Gail Davis, and she still choreographs her shows to this day. She is originally from England, so she was auditioning in London for dancers. I think she likes to keep it close to home, so whenever she looks for dancers for things, she always goes back to London. And then I initially got the job through her, just as a dancer, just as part of the ensemble. And Hans and me kind of kicked it off and got on like a house on fire. And I came back to London after the tour was finished and got a phone call like 3 months later saying, oh, you know, one of the girls is leaving and I was wondering if you might like to come and try, maybe just for 3 months and see if you like it. If you don't, then it's fine. And I thought, oh, just like go there for 3 months and see if I like it. But, you know, I'll probably go back to dancing. And then I stayed 8 years. So yeah, I was hooked, loved it, and never looked back.
When you were dancing in the show in Vegas, were you also doing illusions or were you mainly just as the ensemble?
So I actually never performed in Vegas with Hans. I missed out, which was a real shame because I started the contract after they got back from Vegas. And everyone was chatting about, oh, Pamela Anderson this and that. And, you know, the nights out we had in Vegas, it was amazing. And I was like, oh, I'm like in Germany and it's cold and raining. Like I missed out on that contract. And then there was always the talk of the whole 10 years that I was there, like we're going back to Vegas, we're going back to Vegas. And I was like hanging in there thinking like one day I'll get to go. And now he's back, but I don't work for him anymore. So in January, I was there and I went to watch and I was like, well, at least I kind of made it. I'm in the audience watching you.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you've also done other great things. So
yeah, I mean, I'm not complaining, but I never quite made it into a Vegas show with Hans Klock.
I love that. And so you were in that first show. You had not yet gone into an actual illusion.
No, not yet. Well, actually, no, that's not true. There was one illusion that I did, which was Bump Into the Night.
Sure.
Which is what my floating ball is actually based on, which is the act that I did for BGT. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of nice because I used the first illusion that I'd ever done in my life. And then I turned it around to be something different that was mine. And that was the first thing that I did as a magician in my own right.
Oh, that's so cool. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And so then when did you progress into actually doing illusions with Hans? Because that's a totally different game.
Yeah, it's a very different game. And I don't think many people actually realize how demanding it can be, especially when you work for the fastest illusionist in the world.
Oh my God, it's so fast.
I know. And I remember we were rehearsing when I just started really learning. And we were doing the origami and I had to get in really, really quickly. We just kept doing it and I just couldn't do it quick enough. And then I turned around and I was like, can't you just slow it down like by like 3, 4, 5 seconds? And he was like, I'm the fastest illusionist in the world. I'm not slowing it down for you. Like you need to get quicker. So it was a big transition, a very big transition.
Oh my goodness. Cause I can just imagine him saying that. No, you need to get faster. How does one get faster?
Well, you practice on repeat for months and months and months, and you gain lots of bruises and cuts and scars and injuries, and you just keep doing it until you're not even thinking anymore. You're just jumping or collapsing into these tiny spaces without actually thinking, oh, I'm going to bump my elbow or I'm going to scratch my leg. You just do it.
I think this is part of the reason I quit Illusions.
Yeah. It's nice now because I'm on the other side. So I can kind of be like, Tessa, you need to get in there. And then when people look at me, I'm like, yeah, I did it for 10 years. It's your turn now.
What was sort of the toughest injury or bruise you got when you were the assistant, not the magician yet?
I ended up with concussion once when I ran into black art. Which is really stupid. Yeah, it was so well lit, you couldn't see it. And I hit my head so badly that I ended up in hospital with concussion. It was really bad, really bad. I also got cut in the leg with a sword once during the sword box illusion. It went straight through my calf, which was quite painful. So there were a few things. But by the end of a tour with Hans, you've got so many injuries that you're just like,
It's just part of it.
It's just part of it.
Yeah, I get regular paper cuts. I don't know. I can't relate. I have nothing.
They hurt too.
They do. It's the worst pain.
They are. They actually the are on your face, especially if you get them on the side by the nail. They're unbelievably painful. So.
Thank you for validating me. I needed that. So how did you describe to the hospital, I ran into a black art?
Well, I actually didn't. And that was the amusing thing is that they had the wardrobe lady come with me. And we'd been on tour for like 6 months. And I had no idea what city we were in. Because on tour, you don't. You're in a bus, you wake up, you go to the show, you get back in the bus, you go to sleep, you wake up somewhere else. You don't even know what day it is or anything. So we get there and the doctor's like, you know, so what's your name? And I'm Josephine. Okay, and how old are you? And I'm like, blah, blah. And so do you know where you are? And I'm like, yeah, in the hospital. Yeah, do you know the city? And I'm like, no. Do you know what day it is? And I'm like, no. Do you know what month it is? No. And then the wardrobe lady had to be like, I also don't know these questions. Like, she's fine. Like, she's not like her. They thought I'd hit my head so hard that I just completely blacked out and forgot everything. So they had to explain that everyone on tour had no idea what city we were in or what day it was or what month it was. So yeah.
I get that. I remember we were touring the UK and I think we were in week 4 and we were in Aylesbury parked outside of the theater. And I just walked to the closest Nero and was like, hi, I would like a coffee, but also where am I? And they were like, what is this strange American woman doing? It makes no sense.
Landed somewhere on the planet.
Yeah. No, I get that. That's really great. Cause I love the idea of just having, you have a concussion, but also they think it's way worse. So then what was the moment where you went, I want to be the person outside the box now?
It actually didn't originally come from me. It came from a lot of other people who had been around me and who had seen me in shows. And I'd been approached a couple of times by people who wanted to manage me. And for maybe one or two years, I was like, oh, you know, I'm not really too sure. And I actually felt really nervous about it because it wasn't something that I'd seen anyone really do. And I'd always felt very comfortable just being on stage, but it wasn't ever really my thing. And I was kind of happy just behind Hans, but still having fun taking part. And then I saw a huge opportunity in the fact that as you get older as a dancer, physically, it becomes quite demanding to continue. And I've always been very frightened of not being on stage and not being able to perform. And I thought to myself, actually, maybe this is a way that I can continue doing something that I really like and I can do it for myself and I could continue for maybe another 34 years if I'm successful. So I kind of started looking into it and I had a lot of help from other people. And you said before that BGT was the first thing that you'd ever seen or heard of. That was literally the first thing that I'd ever done on my own. So that'll be why. Because before then I didn't exist. So that was kind of, I'd been approached by the show who had seen me in another show and they wanted to put me on as a female magician. And I was like, I don't even have an act. And when I decided to do it, it was kind of this thing of, you know, I had to do it. And if it goes wrong, then no one knows who I am. So I just go home, have a cup of tea and continue my life. Or it could go well. And if it went well, it could be life changing. So that's how it all came about.
I want to come back to BGT in a little bit. We had a question from someone who calls himself your biggest fan.
Oh.
Richard Young would like to know.
I love Richard.
He's fine. Rich would like to know, what was your favorite memory of working with Hans Klock?
That's such a nice question. I have many, 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 many. But the one that I realized, I've always known that he was such a kind-hearted guy. But when I was on tour with him in Germany and I had the opportunity to... It was actually to go be an Impossible, the magic show. I don't know if you, that was a show in London. Mm-hmm. And that was also a bit of a first shot for me, really, is transitioning over. And we had, I think, 2 or 3 weeks left of the tour. And it meant that if I was to leave, he wasn't going to have anyone. And there were huge cities coming up. So he was like, I can't afford to lose you, especially towards the end. And instead of just letting it be that, he helped me find a replacement. And he literally, morning and night, stayed up trying to sort out how we could find a solution that I could go there, but still do this. And that's when I realized that any other magician, I think, would have been quite hurt that he'd spent so many years training me up. And the idea of them going off on their own and doing something for themselves is almost like, have I just wasted a decade training someone else and putting all this time and effort into that person? And instead he helped me. And then he helped build my box for the floating ball. And he was like, you know, you can do it. And someone like that is just, they're like gold dust because they don't come around often. So the amount of support was very overwhelming. So he's a good guy.
Yeah, I think not every magician gets a mentor. And no. I've also been lucky in that regard where I've always had somebody in my corner helping me with stuff. Yeah. And that's made a significant difference. But also, one thing that I've heard about you, and I think most people know, is that you're probably one of the hardest working people in magic. And
oh,
so,
really?
Yeah, it's a good thing. Yeah. Again, you know, young and strange. So I hear.
That is probably because they asked if I could go and help them with their sewing in half.
Yes.
And I went there to work and instead they just wanted to have tea and coffee every 10 minutes. And they were like, so we've got biscuits, we've got cake. And then we'd do something. And then after 15 minutes, they'd be like, should we have another coffee? And I was like, no, we need to work. But that's probably why you think that.
I've been touring with them for 3 years and that's every day.
Yeah.
So yeah. I totally get it.
If that's what it takes to be called a hard worker, is not have tea and coffee every 5 minutes.
I'm now concerned why they haven't called me a hard worker. Oh. That's probably because I'm also having coffee every 5 minutes. I love that. I love so much that Hans was there for you to help. And I think that's, yeah. Oh, that's so powerful. We had another question written in from Rob Belchunas, who Richard Young is your biggest fan. Rob Belchunas is Shazam's biggest fan because he asks a question in every episode. He wants to know, what was your biggest adjustment that you had to make from assisting in illusions to presenting them?
That was a mental challenge and not a physical one. Because it is very, very daunting when all of a sudden you are stood on stage on your own and you are not used to it. And even as a dancer, that very rarely happens. In musical theatre, that only happens if you're really a lead. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very daunting for me. That feeling of being on stage and having to fill an entire stage and the audience on the other side, that's a mental switch. The feeling like you're in power and in control of yourself and what's happening around you.
one big difference between the magician and the assistant is mm-hmm. the assistant does the physical work, unless you're Hans Klock. And the magician, you know, kind of does less physical work, but also is presenting, which means if something goes wrong,
yeah,
the magician is the one that has to figure that out.
Yeah.
Did you feel that?
There's two sides to that. Because I remember when I worked with Hans, I used to feel quite pressurized sometimes, especially when we did live TV shows, that if it was my responsibility to do well, and if I went wrong, I was letting him down. And when you don't just have a working relationship, but you have that friendship with someone, that makes it 10,000 times worse because you really, really want to do well for that person. There's been times that I've also had a couple of sleepless nights over the fact that, you know, am I going to be able to be that quick? Or what if I drop this? Or what if I do that? And I'm going to let him down. And that's just heart-wrenching. So then you have that aspect of it, but then you do also have the other side of it that if something does go wrong, you know, you need to fix that because you're the one that's going to look stupid. There's different sides to both of those. I don't think it's necessarily, it depends on what your connection is with the people that you are with on stage.
Mm.
Yeah.
So then the first thing you do is BGT.
Yeah. Stupid.
No. Yeah, I mean, I'm curious why you call it stupid, because from my perspective, I call it brilliant because it went so well. But from my understanding, the behind the scenes was significantly more stressful.
It was horrific. I actually cried the whole way there, and we were in the car driving up, and I was like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do this. This is ridiculous. Like, it hasn't even gone right once. And if it wasn't to the unbelievable support from very, very good friends in the car with me who were like, we're going, we're not turning around, I probably wouldn't have done it. But I'd invested so much time in it, and like, it was just blood, sweat and tears because I'd never created anything on my own. You know, I'd never, as an assistant, you turn up, you do your show, you go home. And it was the first time that I'd really spent months just every day trying to work towards creating something. But yeah, it could have gone very wrong. It actually, that was the first time it had ever gone right. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the act, so you can imagine with floating ball what can go wrong.
Everything.
Everything, yeah. I got very lucky.
What was that experience like? Because I don't want to necessarily give away the method. We do have some mm-hmm. listeners that are not magicians. But I think the best way of maybe going around that is lighting is very important.
Yes. For that. Yeah. Your lighting and your setting is very important. So unfortunately, you know, it's not as easy as just doing it anywhere. You know, you really need to have the correct tech support to be able to perform that act. But also, it wasn't even just that. It was also the box that we had made. When you build a new illusion, you have to do it 1,000 times and you need everything to break once to be able to know how to fix it. So whenever you create a new act, there's always this kind of working it in period. And I didn't have that. So going on stage, it was kind of like going out there blind, going, I know there's a million things that can go wrong and they haven't gone wrong yet. It was figuring it all out. Yeah.
Yeah. How much control did you have over a rehearsal, over the tech? Because this is television and there are some significant technical issues. How much rehearsal did you have? Were you able to say, no, use this angle, use this lighting?
I guess it's like with any act, you have a tech rider and they want you to do their show. Then you need to give them your tech rider and they need to abide by it to be able to make things work. So we did have the rehearsal in the morning, which also didn't go well. And then, you know, they give you an hour and then they're like, okay, cool, you're done. And I know I'm not, but okay. They were actually really good to me. That was one thing that I was really worried about. When you go on a show like that, you don't necessarily know how you're going to be represented. And television shows are great at making people look either amazing or they can make you look like you're a ridiculous person who's just coming on hoping that they think you're talented, and you just have to hope for the best. And a lot of the times you see these shows, and I know a lot of people who've done these shows and they've been represented in really bad light, and you think that's not how they said that, or that's not how they meant that, but unfortunately that's how they're represented. So that was also a little bit scary, but I was quite pleased. They were good to me.
That's awesome. So this is kind of a newer adventure for you to be diving into doing this on your own. Like, was there, you mentioned there were people in the car with you. Hans obviously helped with building the illusion. Did you have a team of people helping you create this, or was it mainly just like a good support system? What was that sort of team behind you?
So originally the idea came from Jonathan Goodwin, who came up with this idea, and I was like, yeah, I don't know how to do that. And he was like, neither do I, but we're going to figure it out. And that was amazing, because I think without that, I never would have, you know, I'd just started magic. So I would have been like, well, that's not possible. But he came up with the concept and he figured out how to make it happen, how to do it all. So I had a lot of support from him, but he was in America and I was in England, and it's really hard, you know. You can have that kind of support over the phone and that advice, but back in England, I had very good friends who helped me build and put it all together. So, yeah.
How did you know Goodwin? Had you guys toured together at this point?
We'd worked together 2 years before BGT in Impossible, which is a magic show in West End. And I was an assistant in the show for the first year. And then the second year that the show came back, there had been a lot of talk in the newspapers the year before about how it was very recognizable that it was an all-male lineup. And it had been in The Illusionist, and it had been in every single magic show there was. And English press are great. When they pick something up, they'll just nitpick. And it was all over the paper. You know, it didn't even matter how good the show was. They were concerned that there weren't any females in it. So the second year, Jonathan Goodwin approached the producers and was like, what about putting Josephine in as a magician? So he really, really helped to kind of kickstart everything career-wise moving forward and stuff. So yeah, that's how we met.
That's great. So you mentioned that Goodwin sort of had the idea, then you worked on creating the floating ball. We will link to this routine in the show notes so that everybody can reference it while we're talking about it. And if you haven't seen it, pause now and go watch, because it's great. What was your inspiration for the entire routine aesthetically?
Aesthetically, like you said before, without giving too much away, there are certain things that have to be a certain way. And one of those for me is either an LED screen or a glitter curtain. And an LED screen is amazing because you can put whatever graphics you want on there, but a glitter curtain or a slash, I think you call them Mylar curtains. Is that what you call them in America? Yeah. And that's always really bothered me, that there's always this like silver, like glitter curtain. I'm like, yeah, that's not how I envisioned it. Like, I wanted it to be really sexy, and it's not. It's like 80s Vegas. So aesthetically, unfortunately, I always get stuck with that. But I wanted it to look like it was just a box. And that's it. Because with these illusions, you know, I sometimes find that they're so dated, that they look so aesthetically so done up, and they're all like, you know, they've painted them all these bright colors and things, and it's just like, well, of course magic happens in it, because, you know, no one's gonna have that furniture lying around their house. Like, you can tell that it's built to be an illusion. And I just wanted it to be a box, just a box that you could find in the garage. So yeah,
I read an article once that you took a lot of inspiration from Maleficent from Sleeping Beauty.
Yeah. Yeah. So I love that character that Angelina Jolie plays. And she's just a powerhouse. She puts her hand out and everything moves. And she has this incredible force within her. And I love that concept. And I think that if there is going to be this empowered female magician, it should be something that she is representing, which is not the evil side of her, but the power within her.
When I read that, I got very excited. I'm obsessed with Maleficent, maybe too much, but I'm obsessed with the original 1940s version of Maleficent. Oh, the original Sleeping Beauty cartoon.
Right.
Oh, it's fantastic. Okay. Yeah, the idea of Maleficent, this is what's important in this episode, not anything else. Stomping. Because I really agree with you, is that Maleficent has this glide to her, whether it's the Angelina Jolie version or the original cartoon, is like, she doesn't walk.
No.
She floats. And there's something so powerful about just hitting your stick on the floor and everything happens.
And she's got this grace to her. She's so graceful. You know, like you said, she doesn't walk, she floats. Every movement is just so sophisticated and classy. Everything that she embodies is just power.
Yeah. Love it. It was so clear too. Once I read that article, I was like, oh yeah, no, I see that in this routine so much. Cause it's as little movement as possible from you with the most amount of magical impact. I think that's really brilliant. And so then you go from a floating ball into a things that go bump, and then you're done. And all of a sudden you have a panel of judges staring you down. What was that moment like? Cause obviously they loved it.
I think when that happened, there was a moment of, did it go right? Because there's a lot of things that are happening that I'm not in control of. And it was like, did all the doors drop open? You know, there was all this. And I think I was just so relieved that we'd done it, that I remember I was standing there and I was almost like being in a dream, thinking like, oh, you know, I can't really hear what's happening. Like, did it happen? Oh my God, it's over. It was just nice to be out on the other side after months of stress. Yeah.
And then you got such great feedback. Was there a particular, were you like, this is what I'm hoping for? Was there a particular amount of feedback from a certain person that you're like, that really, I'll dine out on that for the rest of my life?
To me, it wasn't even really about what they were going to say. I think for me, it was just creating something and putting it on stage and getting to that point was a huge thing. And that for me was enough. Whether they liked it or not, I was, you know, for me, I was like, I've done it. I've got an act. Yes.
And then from there, you have, there are a total of 3 rounds in BGT. Is that right?
Yeah. There's 3 rounds. I did the second round and I didn't get through to the third round. And nobody actually, well, I might have mentioned it before, but I was actually quite relieved when I didn't get through to the third round because I didn't have anything else. I'd only just started and I'd stupidly not thought that I might get through. For me, I was like, let's do an act, let's put it on the show and let's just start. And then it all happened so quickly. And then I was onto the second round and I was like, wow, okay, I need a second act. I don't actually have one because I've kind of just started on my own. So it all happened so fast that part of it actually happened a little bit too quickly because I hadn't actually expected to be that successful on the show. So when I didn't get through to the third round, there was a part of me that was like, oh, thank God, because I knew that I think I would have only had maybe a week or 2 weeks to put something together. And I was so frightened that I'd put something out that hadn't fully been prepared, that all the work that I'd done leading up to it could have potentially been ruined in the space of 2 minutes. And I didn't want that. So yeah, I think I'm probably the only person who's ever done BGT who didn't want to get to the final.
Oh, that's awesome. And then after BGT, when did you go into Illusions as a magician?
Pretty much straight after BGT. I got really lucky that after I did the show, the work just came rolling in. And I was doing The Illusionist and after that, show after show after show. And it was amazing because then I had that opportunity then to start coming up with new acts and testing them and then trying them out on stage. And then, so if I did BGT now, I think I would do it quite differently because now I'd be both prepared. Yeah.
Yeah, you have a lot more to choose from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So you got right into Impossible. Was Impossible in the West End?
Yes, it was.
This is my favorite thing. I had never performed before. I just did BGT and then I'm in the West End and I've just kept going. That's amazing.
Oh, thank you. It has actually been a bit of a whirlwind of a ride the past 3 years. So I've been so lucky, really, really lucky. And I've enjoyed every single part of it. And I'm really missing it now.
Yeah, because you were going. I saw a picture of your schedule on your Instagram where it was just a constant tour schedule.
Yeah,
and it was amazing. Now there's nothing.
Now there's nothing, I know. We were actually supposed to be, this summer, we were supposed to be doing Masters of Illusion in Lake Tahoe.
Oh, cool.
Which I was so excited about. also because I'd never been to Lake Tahoe, and it was just like summer there doing magic, and it was going to be amazing. But that's not happened.
Sure. Yeah. I understand. There was a lot going on for all of us. So you go into Impossible, you're in the West End, you're onto the Illusionists. Oh my gosh, you're just going. And then when did you do The Next Great Magician?
That was, I have no idea, the same year as BGT, I think.
Okay.
Actually, I did that just before BGT, and I did the Soaring and Half, so I just did Standards. And then BGT was the first time I'd ever created anything for.
Yeah, that's so cool. So then what was your experience like on The Next Great Magician? Can you also explain a little bit about the show? Because it was not a thing over here.
Oh, okay. So Next Great Magician was a TV show that they did in England. And the concept was, it actually changed throughout the show. I can't remember in the end how they released it, but it was, I think they had 5-6 magicians on each episode. And I think originally the magicians would watch each performance and then they would vote for the performance that they wanted to win. So it was kind of a bit of a battle between the magicians, and then they decide. And I think originally when it started, the magicians would hear what each other had to say about their act. But then as it went on, I think it changed, and then you didn't hear what the other magicians were saying about your act. So I can't actually remember when it was released, how they released it, whether... Anyway, so that was a concept, one of those. But it was amazing because there were all sorts of magicians coming from all over the world to London to do this TV show. And it was a really successful TV show. It was good. We don't have that so much in England, that kind of cabaret/variety shows so much anymore. You know, that's very European, especially in France. They have a lot of variety shows over there. We don't have that so much. So it's quite nice to have a TV show like that where you do have a variety of different acts or magic related, but different styles.
And I like too, because it was, you could bring your best stuff. Because here we've had a lot of television shows that are like, here's a bunch of stuff that we just found. You have an hour.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm not a big fan of that concept because I feel like it doesn't make you look as good if you only have. Yeah. So I love the idea of being able to say, you know, we have AGT, obviously, which is just an intense powerhouse. But from there isn't really like a platform for magicians to perform their best material.
We have Penn and Teller.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. I should remember that.
Yeah,
I was on it.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
I've lost my mind.
Apart from that, though, yeah.
Yeah, you're right. And then, but you know, yes, Penn and Teller, AGT, and that's kind of it. Yeah. So it's cool to have The Next Great Magician because there is such a cool platform to do kind of whatever you want. Because you know, Catherine Mills went into a restaurant.
I know. Oh, that was brilliant. Was that the when? She changes outfit, doesn't she?
Yeah, into a wedding dress. Oh,
so good. So good. Yeah,
it's cool. It's so cool because you could just do whatever you do best.
I do find that though, there have been a couple of TV shows that I've been invited to and they don't want to pay for the transport for my illusions because it's going to cost them thousands to fly it somewhere. And then, you know, they say, oh, is that something that we can hire from a magician here for you to do? And I also always struggle with that because I'm like, well, it's like saying to a ballerina, oh, I've got some tap shoes. Do you want to put them on and just see what you can do? You know, it doesn't work like that. That doesn't show you in your best light. But then you do have a lot of magicians who have done magic for so long that they have such an array of acts and they can do every single skill under the sun. And for someone like that, it is easy to just pick something up and bash something together. So, yeah.
Yeah, but maybe they're good at that. They can do that.
Yeah.
Not I'll everyone's like that. Yeah. Yeah, good point. Good point. So then what other, you just did Masters of Illusion, right? The television show.
Yeah. So we did that in January. And then after I did the TV show, that's when I got offered the live show and never made it there. Maybe next year.
Maybe next year. Yeah, I'm sure it's going to be really interesting what happens post-pandemic, because by the time this episode comes out, What am I saying? Nothing's going to change. But yeah, maybe by the time this comes out, you'll be like, oh yeah, I am going to Lake Tahoe.
Oh, I wish.
Fingers crossed. I mean, I get it. I'm itching to get back on the road.
I know. We're all in the same boat. There's something kind of comforting about that, though, actually, that, I mean, not that I would ever wish for everyone to be in any awful position, but, you know, at the beginning, situations across the world were so different. So I think, you know, I was looking at other people's Instagram and thinking, like, oh, we sat in the house, stuck here for, you know, a month, and they're on the beach and God knows where. And then, you know, everything turned so quickly, and now everyone's in the same boat, which... I don't wish on anyone, but there is something comforting that we're all at home.
Yeah, it's, you know, I live in LA, as you know, and Hollywood has been really fascinating to watch because my partner is in acting and comedy and stuff. So just watching how Hollywood's been dealing with it is like, yeah, there's a lot of out of work actors right now. And so it's just comparing is like, all right, so it's not just magicians. We had the big economic crash a good 15 years ago in America, and like no entertainers worked, but a lot of people were okay, but then a lot of people weren't. And now it's like everyone's doing it. Yeah.
It's crazy.
So how many illusionists tours have you done?
I did a big European tour, which was 8 or 9 months long in 2017 to 18. And then since then, I've not actually worked for them. I got offered their Australian tour, which I was so excited about because the tour that I did with them previously had been in Russia, Belarus. They were all really cool places, but they were like kind of places that I've seen and I'm happy to go somewhere else a bit warmer now. And then got offered the tour in Australia, and it was in Sydney Opera House. And for me, that was just the dream. You know, it's always West End, Broadway, Sydney Opera House. They're kind of the things that you want to tick off. And I'd already signed another contract, and I couldn't do the show, so I missed out on the entire tour. I know.
Oh, no.
But then at the time, I remember I was so devastated, and it took me a long time to get over it. But actually, the other show that I did led to something else. So it kind of worked out in the end, but I miss Sydney.
Yeah. That's so sad. And have you done Broadway yet? Is that something
it's a
goal?
I say yet, because it's like,
of course.
Yeah. No, not yet.
So exciting. I think that, yeah, it seems, I mean, fingers crossed for when things come back, because The Illusionist obviously is in Broadway like once a year. So
yeah.
That'd be so fun.
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. You've done so much and it's so amazing, and you're constantly pre-pandemic touring and all of this. But I want to talk to you about how you create a new piece, and where does your brain go when you're like, oh yeah, this is how I want to make a new illusion piece. What are you inspired by? How does that start for you? Because it's completely different, I think, compared to what I do, which is, oh, I don't know, I'll just throw something together and see what happens. So,
oh, really?
I think it's not
a bit more of that. I think if I had that mentality, then I sometimes things would move a lot quicker. Sometimes I think about things too much, and then 6 months goes past, and I'm like, if I just tried that, then maybe it would have worked. I actually recently, well, it was at the beginning of the year, I started putting something together that was my idea of my next floating ball act. So my floating ball to me was kind of like my baby. And then I did a lot of stuff that was off the shelf. And I've kind of been waiting until I had an idea that I was like, that's it, that's my next floating ball act. And in January, I had this kind of bingo moment, and I was like, I've got it, I'm gonna start it. And when I've got that and I know that I feel really passionate about something, then I'm like, okay, I'm doing it. So I got it already, and it sat in the unit down the road waiting to get on stage. But it was something that I changed a million times in my head, and I normally visualize what it looks like. I was actually having this conversation with someone yesterday that my brain works backwards to how magicians think. And instead of thinking of the magic trick, I will always first visualize what it looks like aesthetically, how I see myself on stage, what I'm wearing, what the music's like. So I see the end product and then I work backwards and I'm like, right, what magic trick could fit into that scenario? Whereas I know with a lot of magicians, because their background is ultimately magic, they find the magic trick first and then the rest. So
what's really interesting about that statement, and this is, I don't actually have this data collected, but I think a lot of women, because I work that same way, and a lot of the women in magic I'm friends with also work the same way of, what's the point of this? What do I want this to look like? I don't care about method right now. I'll figure that out later, because what's the most magical this can look? And I actually learned that from another woman and was like, oh, that's a much better way of looking at magic. Yeah.
When I spoke with Connie Boyd, she said exactly the same. She said exactly the same, that she works the other way around. So yeah, it's interesting how the brain works and different people. Yeah.
Well, you also come from, you and Connie come from a dancer background, and I was also a dancer.
Yeah.
That's not really accurate. I took classes. I can't touch my toes. What am I talking about? But also, when you have any kind of training in theater, acting, dance, you come from that. Well, what does this look like to the audience?
Yeah, exactly. And I think ultimately that is what you are doing it for, is how is the audience going to see it? What does it make them feel? Because I came from a background in dancing. When I hear music, it makes me feel something. You kind of, I think, start where you feel safe and what resonates with you.
Yeah, the piece I did on Fool Us came from hearing that, hearing a song. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I love it. It's so nice. It's so beautiful. Thanks. And it's so simple. Like, the concept of it is so simple. I'm going to sit on a chair and rip up a heart. But it's so beautifully done. I really love it. I remember I saw it and I was like, it just goes to show that you don't need all these big things. And have a piece of paper and it can be so beautiful.
I have this podcast just so I can ask people I admire what they think of my Fool Us.
Well, there you go.
Yes. There you go. No, thank you. That's very kind. I appreciate it. And also, I really get the idea of going with using music or using a concept or using some piece of you to put it into what you do. And one thing that I really enjoy about everything I've seen of yours, which has only been video, is that there's no question who you are. What was that like? How did you develop such a clear performance persona where you're like, yeah, no, there's no question, this is Josephine. If you describe the act, it's Josephine. Boom.
That's interesting you say that, actually, because when I was on tour with Rudy Kobe and Ed Alonso, we had this conversation and they said what you need is a character, because once you define your character, everything else then becomes clear. So, you know, are you a superhero? Okay, you're the superhero. Great. You're going to do these kind of illusions because that's what superhero illusions, you know, if you're going to be that Lara Croft character, then it's easy to pick, you know, you're not going to do a floating ball. You're going to do something that's dynamic and powerful. And for instance, with Rudy Kobe, his character is so clear. So it's so easy to pick the funny, comical things that he's going to do. And same with Ed. And I thought long and hard about who is my character. I'm actually not too sure that I have one, and started to really panic that maybe I'm doing it wrong because I've not figured out who I am yet. And the more I thought about it, they are right. You know, you need to have this persona, but whether you have to have a character as such, I'm not entirely sure. I think it's good to kind of have that advice and to take it and to take little bits from it, but there's a lot of people out there who you think are a character, but in actual fact they're just being themselves, like David Blaine, for instance, or we've got Dynamo, Hans Klok. They're not really pretending to be someone, they are just themselves. And it works. So I actually think I've just been myself, and that's just happened in time, and it's just unraveled. And yeah, I think I'm just being me. And sometimes that works.
How would you define you specifically about who is Josephine once you hit the stage?
I think there is definitely an alter ego as such, because I'm not really a confident person in normal social situations. You know, I'm never going to be the first person to stand up and sing karaoke, or I'm not the loud person in the corner putting on a party. But when I step on stage, I'm someone very, very different. I feel like I'm in control of myself, and there is this alter ego as such. But I think everything is just enhanced when I go on stage. I'm me, but a bigger version of me.
Yeah. Then how do you choose material to fit that bigger version of you? Like, how do you know what, that's not going to work? Or, oh, what's the cool spin I can put on this thing?
I try to pick topics that resonate with me. Like the second act that I did for Britain's Got Talent was a Women in Magic act. And I think a lot of it was sometimes misunderstood and came across as a bit of, I'm a feminist and I hate men and you should all die and, you know, women, women, women. And it wasn't meant to be like that at all. It was meant to be more of an inspirational act for the younger generation or little kids who wanted to be magicians but had never seen a woman on stage. So I think if you pick material that resonates with you, it's a lot easier to pick material. That's why it's hard to, I think sometimes you have to just not listen to other people's advice, because a lot of people think that they know and they say, that would suit you. I saw this other guy do it. You'd look great doing that. And then you look at it and you're like, I don't see myself doing that at all. Nothing excites me about that. So I think when picking material, if you find something that resonates with you, then it'll fly. Yeah.
My dad's been trying to get me to do a silk act since I was 8 years old.
You're not feeling that, it?
No. There's no.
Is that a magician?
No. I mean, if you asked him, he'd say he has an entire rope act. He's very proud of his cut and restored rope routine. But no, Lord, no. But no, I really get that. And I think it probably just happens to all magicians, is people go, you should totally do this thing. And you're like, yeah, no.
Great. Well, a lot of the time it's nice to have that. That's how you get ideas. But a lot of the time you get ideas by having the ideas that you're like, no, that's not good. And then you go completely the opposite direction. And then you end up finding that thing. And you're like, if you hadn't told me that really shitty idea, I never want to get to the good one. So those conversations are great to have. But they're also conversations that you should take what feels good to you and not always listen to everything. Because I know when I started magic, I thought that everything that any magician told me was the right thing. And that was the right way to do it. And I have to do it like that. And whereas the more experienced I've become, the more I've realized that ultimately you're the one on stage. So you decide what makes you feel good.
Yeah. If it doesn't make you feel good or you're not having fun, then.
Exactly. Don't do it.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think are some things that magicians who don't do illusions don't understand about doing illusions? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I can answer that quite quickly. So I think a lot of magicians who don't do illusions see it as there's a prop, there's specific things that need to happen with it. You know, you're going to cut someone in half, Bob. You just pick up the saw or the blade, you pop it in, you cut her in half, you get it out. She's in two parts, it's done. That isn't quite how it works, though. And I think people who don't do illusions should at least try, because once you try, you understand that it's not actually about the illusion, and it never was about the illusion. It was about the way that you presented it. So it's exactly the same as doing an act with a pack of cards. You have to find your own spin on it. Yeah, there's specific things you need to do, but it's not just a box trick. I hate that. Box trick. What box trick? It's an illusion.
there are a lot of boxes. What are we talking about?
Yeah, but they're not boxes though, are they?
No, they are. it's intense. I really like what you said. Just try one.
Just try one.
Just try one.
And I think that's the other thing, is I think people are very quick to just assume that something's easy, but there's close-up magicians who think close-up magic is really easy, and I find it much harder. I don't feel comfortable doing close up at all. You know, everyone's got their own skills and everyone's good at different things, but they should not judge other people until they've tried them.
Well, yes, there's a reason I don't do illusions, and that's because they're too hard. It's too hard for me.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think most people assume that illusions are much easier than normal close-up magic.
I think they both have something that makes them easier, and they both have something that makes them harder.
Yeah.
It's like close-up is hard because I'm this close to someone. So you could catch me do something if I do it a split second too early.
Yeah.
Illusions is like, whew.
I had this conversation with Richard Young, and he asked me how I felt about close-up, and he said he found it interesting that I would rather be on stage in front of like 5,000 people than walk up to a table with just 5 people on it. To me, that is daunting. Because with parlor magic and close-up, they're having dinner, so they don't always necessarily want to be performed to. So if you can go over there, you're not just performing, you will first have that battle to get them to want to watch you. And that in itself is an unbelievably hard skill. And I have so much respect for people who can do that, because that's much, much harder, I think, than standing on stage and performing to people who have paid a ticket to be there and they're waiting for you to do it.
Yeah, that's definitely, I don't enjoy doing strolling, which both in the UK and in here, that's a massive market for close-up magicians. And yeah. I don't like it because I don't like convincing people that they want to be entertained. Yeah. I hate it.
Yeah.
But when people are sat down watching you, yeah. I totally agree. I love that so much more. This is my act. I have a deck of cards, maybe some coins, and a wrist full of rubber bands, and I can do 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's also a nice little added element to close-up versus...
And, and you actually give yourself more opportunity than someone like me, because I've had cruise ships approach me and they want a 2-hour show that fits in a suitcase. And I'm like, have you seen my trailer? I think you called the wrong person. But then immediately I shoot myself in the foot a little bit, because I can't go do the job because I don't have that 2-hour show yet. Whereas you can turn up with a suitcase, you can do your 2-hour show and you can make your money. So there's different sides to everything. But I've heard that so many times, and that's something that I really need to follow up on, is pack small, play big. I enjoy illusions so much that I'm like, yeah, let's just make another one. Let's make another one. But...
Yeah, but also, like you said, if you're not feeling it, don't do it, right? So if it's not of interest to you, do you have – one question I have is, what happens if something happens with the illusions? Maybe they don't turn up to the theater, or – because we've had that happen with Champions of Magic where a whole truck didn't show up.
Really? We're like,
where's the truck? And Young and Strange don't have a show now. Luckily, there are 5 of us, so we can cover and make everything work, which is great, but – yeah. Has anything like that ever happened to you? And do you have any sort of backup where you're like, I just keep 20 minutes of material over here just in case?
No. And that's something that I'm constantly working on. There's smaller stuff that I can do, but I always feel most comfortable when I've got my acts and I know what I'm doing. These are my acts. And it's interesting because there's a couple of magicians that I know who only have 1 or 2 acts, and they've made an entire career and a very good money just doing that one act. You know, like a lot of famous quick change artists, they have 3 minutes and they turn up and they do the same 3 minutes for 30, 40 years and they earn well, and that's what they do. It's kind of like circus. And I think I've kind of been working in that area. But recently, I've started doing a bit of talking in acts and actually realized that I enjoy it. And so that's been, for me, a bit of a switch in the...
That's so cool.
...in the way that I want to work moving forward. Because it's something that I never really did. You know, I was dancing, then I was a magician's assistant, and then went into doing illusions and never actually did much talking material, and then recently did. And I was like, actually, this is quite fun.
So what does that material look like? Are you talking through an illusion? Are you just giving like an introduction?
So for Masters of Illusion, the TV show that we did at the beginning of the year, we did a rope trick, which I was actually really sad about because when I saw the final edit, it had been so watered down. I was like, oh, it's not that funny. But originally the act was almost taking the mickey a little bit of the guy and the rope and him tying me up. And it was fun. And it was fun for him as well. But I think it's American TV and you're a little bit more conservative though than we are over here. So they took out a couple of bits because I think they were concerned that there were children watching. But when I did that act, I started coming up with things that I hadn't scripted or anything. And I was thinking to myself, actually, this is fun. This is nice. You get to play with the audience a little bit. So,
yeah, and that routine is so easily travelable too.
Yeah. There you go. I've got 2 minutes.
Yes. I love though that you've got, because one downside to what I do is because I'm, or at least I try to be funny and it's close up, is that when I travel, I can only go to English speaking countries. You don't have that problem. And it's something that I would like to work on, is having more material to music that can work without me talking. And now you've got both a speaking piece. Yeah, it's really smart.
It is interesting because I'd never thought of that before. I'd always thought that if you talk, then you can put 2 hours together. And I was always slightly envious of friends who are mentalists and they just go on stage and they chat and it's 20 minutes has gone by. But you're right though, especially during the pandemic, I've had a couple of job offers, only like one-off gigs or TV shows, but I don't need to talk. I can go to another country where it's a little bit better and I can do a show there. So there are highs and lows of everything, aren't there? There's good and bad. So it is interesting. It's very interesting how many different avenues there are in the industry.
What are some things that when you watch another illusionist, what are some things that you're like, I hate when illusionists do that?
So I have a very, very soft spot for Hans Clark.
Sure.
A very, very soft spot. He's all I've ever known. So this kind of jumping around on stage and, you know, the dramatic music. And to me, that's all I've ever known. Whenever I see someone else do it, I'm like, oh, so dated. When Hans does it, I'm like, oh, I love it. It's so fun. And I think that he gives it his all. So it's just whenever you watch him, he sells himself. So you're so immediately warmed by him and you're like, I love this guy. But I can't stand that kind of 80s, you know, like things have changed a little bit since then. And yeah, I think magic has evolved quite a bit from how it was back in the day.
I've never met Hans, never worked with him, but I agree, as he's the only person I think that can get away with that kind of act. When you say evolved, I think I know what you mean, but what do you mean when you say magic has evolved from that 80s style of dramatic, I'm this all-powerful wizard, to, well, pre-pandemic 2020?
I love how we've got pre-pandemic. what do I mean by evolve? I mean, when you look back to the David Copperfield specials and the kind of 70s, 80s magic, this whole, as you put it, box magic, things have evolved in the sense that, for instance, I actually think David Blaine was a huge turning point for magic because he rocked up and he wasn't pretending to be anything. And he's just this cool guy who got out some coins and was like, want to watch. If you actually watch him, there's not much performing going on. He's just being himself. And I think most other magicians will have looked at that and been like, are you kidding? This guy's not even trying. And he's like, I'd be quite annoyed if I was back in the day because he didn't try and it worked. And I think people didn't expect it to, and it did work. And this whole idea of ta-da-da, loud flashy music and glitter curtains and disco lights, they realized you didn't need any of that. You can just turn up with a pack of cards and coins, be on the street, wear jeans and not leather pants, and magic still works. So
I had a college student say to me one time at a show in like a Q&A thing, the question was something along the lines of, do you see magic being in the flashy, on this all-powerful magician kind of way, or do you see it more relatable and organic and fun? And I was like, I think you just answered your own question, because you called one of them fun,
yeah,
and one of them dated. And yeah, it's so obvious that audiences really want a more organic connection, yeah, even if it's an illusion. Like, if you're a person on stage that's relatable and interesting, then yeah, the audience is going to watch you.
Exactly. And I think that's the thing. You have to resonate with an audience. And if you have this persona of being unapproachable, sometimes it works. I don't know if you know Aaron Crow. Do you know
Aaron? Yeah,
yeah. So Aaron is the sweetest guy. I don't know if you've met him in person. He, like, you see his acts and you're like, wow, this guy must be scary. And then you meet him and he's just like this soft-hearted, sensitive guy. And you're like, I'm so confused. But his act, he's the only person I know who can get away with this hard persona of almost being unapproachable. But it works because it draws you in. But not many people, I think, I don't really know anyone else who can do an act like that and it be a silent act and so successful. Like, people want to be able to relate to whoever they're watching on stage. You know, they want the guy next door or the girl next door. Magic for Humans is the perfect example of that. It's just fun. And he's talking to normal people.
Yeah. And he's normal.
And he's normal. And that's the thing. That's what it's about. We're doing magic, but we're all human.
Yep. Yeah. I really like Michael Carbonaro and the Carbonaro Effect as yeah, well, because it's pranky. It's a prank show in a sense, more candid camera like than a magic show. But he's so likable because he's not trying to be this wizard. He's just a guy checking you out at the store. He's, oh, great. Well, you know, scan that. So your total is going to be $65. Have you seen this thing with the baby chickens? And you're like, wait, what's happened? And he's just normal. He's not even a magician. And I yeah, crave that so much. I totally agree with you. And I think for illusions, is like, if you're a normal person, then the illusions yeah, seem more interesting because it's not a wizard doing it. It's a human.
Yeah, it's a lot harder actually to achieve that with illusions, mm-hmm, a lot harder, which is, I think, why I've maybe taken that concept of just being me and I'm doing illusions. Sometimes there's a story or a meaning behind it, but for instance, the Soaring in Half act that I do, I get someone up from the audience. Well, everyone can relate because they could have been that person in the audience, but it is harder to achieve that with illusions.
I've never seen you perform live, but I think you do it well because, well, you can act. So that's helpful. That's really good. And so I feel like you seem like a human that just also happens yeah, to have this ability.
It's good to know.
Yeah. But yeah, I think that also, please correct me if I'm wrong, I would say it helps to have been a dancer and know how yeah, to perform on stage and relate. Like, if you can get the audience in a look, then you've won, right? And that's the whole idea.
Yeah.
You have to get them on your side quickly. And for a dancer, is you can get them with just looking at them or with your yeah, hand or something, which is great. For me, it's like, I'm a goofball, so I just try to be funny right off the bat. But for you and for an illusionist, getting them right away with that facial expression, yeah, boom, you've won.
Yeah. Well, I hope so.
Yeah.
sometimes not. That's the aim.
That's the goal. I like the goal. That's the goal. Yeah.
Our Books to Read segment this week is brought to you by A Bunch of Books. It's the Eli Marks Mystery Series. I know this is a regularly recommended book, but I'm going to mention it for a very specific reason. So this past week, a project that Carissa and I did with Penguin Magic came out. Yay! It's my very first marketed product, so it's kind of exciting for me. And we had taken some of the tricks from the Tommy Wonder series that were just more difficult to perform in 2020. For example, there's a card to cigarette case, sort of along those lines, where a card ends up in the case and then in the actual cigarette itself, etc. There's more to it than that. I did not do a good job of explaining it, but you get the idea. Doing magic where a card ends up in a cigarette, maybe not so great for now. It could be, but you might want another option. So we put a kind of modern twist on some of those effects. And then some of the tricks in the book also specifically relied on pockets. So we did a really comprehensive job of making sure you don't need pockets in order to do some of this. So we tried to make the tricks as gender neutral as possible. I am such a huge Tommy Wonder fan. It's an obsession of mine. He was a really big influence to me when I started going into the professional magic realm. And it was such an honor to be a part of putting my own and our own twist on Tommy Wonder's material. Obviously, Tommy was a genius. I will never be as good at magic as he was. And I enjoyed just being able to add our own personality, including in the product, we have a Ringwatch wallet. It's not a Ringwatch wallet. It is an effect we performed in the Peller Theater at the castle. It got rave reviews, and it uses a ring, a necklace, and an earring, and all of them come back. So we're very proud of that, and that is a part of the project too. And you can get this project at Penguin Magic right now. I'm going to put the link in the show notes, but that's not the point of this. I'm not trying to sell you necessarily, but I want to remind everyone the books are worth multiple rereads. So even with our modern updates, the tricks and theories in the Wonder series are worth revisiting all the time. I think I look back at them once or twice a year to remind myself of some deep magic theory. It feels like I'm asking the legend Tommy Wonder for advice, and he's got an answer for absolutely everything. One of the things that really sticks with me is his opinion on failure magic effects, where a magician pretends to have failed, and why it's just not a good idea to do that. And that's something that after reading it and really thinking about that idea, I omitted failure effects, the one where a magician pretends to fail and then actually succeeds in the end. Those don't exist in my act anymore because Tommy's right. So go check that out. If you haven't already, please get the Wonder series. If you have to choose between getting the Wonder series and our product, get the Wonder series. That's a no-brainer. It just changed who I was as an early professional performer. Boom! This segment was sponsored by the Eli Marks Mystery Series. Master illusionist Jim Steinmeier had this to say about the series. A wonderfully engaging, delightfully tricky bit of mystery. Fans of magic will delight in the artful use of the world of magicians on stage and off stage. It's a great story and great fun. You can pick up the first book in the series, The Ambitious Card, for just 99 cents. Grab your copy at elimarksmysteries.com. That's E-L-I-M-A-R-K-S mysteries.com. The Historical Women segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Lulu Hurst was born in 1886 in Polk County, Georgia. She was a vaudeville performer known for her very weird powers. You might know her as the Georgia Magnet. A Georgia Wonder Act in Superfest summary is where a strong audience volunteer, usually a guy, picks up the performer, usually a woman, with ease. He's super strong, can pick her up no problem, and then because of her strange abilities, he then tries again and she suddenly just weighs a ton. There are also other elements based off of touch. The performer exhibits super strength with just the tip of their finger. So Lulu Hurst was the first woman to perform this style of magic. According to Magicpedia via GenieMagazine.com, there was a part of her show where a male volunteer held a cane between both of his hands. She would touch the cane and then he would suddenly be unsteady and often just fall over. Her act became so famous that at only 15 years old, she was touring across the country. Sadly, people stole her act and others started to understand all her methods, so in 1885, she canceled the tour of Europe and just retired. But in 1897... she published an autobiography, The Full Georgia Magnet Act, which contained her methods to the act. Lulu Hurst died May 13, 1950. This segment is sponsored by the Penguin Magic Podcast, hosted by Eric Tate. Every week, if you listen to the Penguin Magic Podcast, you get a 25% discount code on the featured download of the week. You can hear stories from your favorite magicians, behind the scenes at Penguin, and save money on some of the best new magic. Visit podcast.penguinmagic.com to find out more. The Let's Make It Vanish segment is brought to you by the LA Collusion. My understanding of why the Hindu Shuffle is called the Hindu Shuffle is because folks in Asia hold and shuffle cards basically in this biddle grip. But what I found also showed that the first publication of the Hindu Shuffle as the Hindu Shuffle was by Jean Hugard in 1934. So could it technically be argued, of course, that this shuffle is named after how a geographical region shuffles cards? Yeah, sure. And are Nepal and India the two countries with the largest majority of Hindus in Asia? Yes. I'm just not sure it's a necessary name. you know, I get what a lot of you are probably thinking. PC culture is trying to get rid of everything we hold dear. Sure. But I've just seen magic students, those completely new to magic, cringe with confusion at the title of this trick. Some of these students are from Asian countries. Some of them are from Asian descent. Some of them are Hindu. And I'll take my cue from them, as they are not comfortable, but being comfortable enough to express that uncomfortability with the title of this shuffle and this force. So I propose that we rename the Hindu shuffle. I have before called it the ski slope shuffle, because when I explain to new magicians, to students, how to hold the cards and how to do this, I explain that their elbow and wrist are the top of the bunny hill, and then your opposite hand shuffling the cards is the ski lodge where you get the hot chocolate. You know what I'm talking about? I love hot chocolate. Okay, I might go get some after this. Anyway, back to the point. I'll post a video of how I explain this to students too. You're welcome to use it. I think it's really fun, and students definitely absorb how to do this shuffle much better. So I called it the ski slope shuffle, but that might not make sense to most people. So a better name might be the angled shuffle, the lateral shuffle, the 45 degree shuffle, the horizontal. I'm not really sure. There are a lot of possible names. So I would be very curious what everyone thinks. I would probably tend to go with the angled shuffle just because it's at an angle. Maybe that works. Let's see. What do you think? What is the best rename for the Hindu shuffle? So send me a message or comment. Do it on the video that I post about the ski slope shuffle and tell me what you think the best rename for the Hindu shuffle would be. Also, we have a patron shout out this week. So Sam Wheeler, thank you so much for being a producer. You are my hero. And so for you, Sam, because I called this the ski slope shuffle, I want to give you a suggestion on the perfect hot chocolate. This is just for you. No one else can make this. Sam, this is your hot chocolate recipe. Okay. So cocoa powder, obviously. Almond milk. I don't know if you're vegan, but I'm vegan, and so it's important. So I'm going to go with almond milk. It makes a great hot chocolate. Oat milk also is a great milk substitute for hot chocolate, but almond milk is just a little bit sweeter, so you don't have to really add too much sweetener. So I have cocoa powder, almond milk. You get it all warm. You mix in some maple syrup for the sugary. Delicious. And for you, you add fresh mint. Some fresh mint leaves, heat it up in that pot, and if you just want to get a little bit crazy, throw in some vanilla vodka. And then if you top it off with a candy cane, so you put the candy cane in it, so as it kind of melts, it even gets more minty, and boom, you have wintertime hot chocolate. You are welcome, Sam. Also, thank you. Thank you, and you are welcome. This was brought to you by the LA Collusion, a society of magicians of all backgrounds focused on improving the art of magic through culture, creativity, and communication. To find out more, check out the link in the show notes.
As is the point of Shazam, I don't know if you know this, but you're a woman. And what's been your experience where has there been positives? Has there been negatives? What's sort of been your experience based off of your gender within magic? Have you gotten more opportunity, less opportunity? Go.
That's an interesting question. And I think it's interesting to say, have I had more opportunity? I don't think I will ever know. I don't think I will ever know if I was hired because I was female and maybe they needed to stick a female on the poster of The Illusionist or Impossible. Like, for sure, with Impossible, I know that they wanted to prove that point that we need a female in the show, so let's get some. And that led to many, many other opportunities for me, so that's great. I don't think I'll ever know, though, truly whether I was hired because they thought my act was great. I'd like to hope that that's the case. But who knows? Who knows? It's a funny world that we live in. There's a lot of politics in general, as well as in the industry. I think it's almost naive to ignore that. You never really know what's going on behind the scenes. So yeah, potentially maybe I have had a couple of opportunities because I was female. If that's the case, then yay! I'm going to try and celebrate it instead of thinking it's a bad thing. I mean, it's hard. There's a lot of issues going on in the world right now with race, with gender equality, with what sexuality you are. There's a million issues that need to be sorted out. I think all we can do is keep doing what we enjoy and keep trying to put a lighthearted spin on things as much as we can and just keep working hard, you know? I think at the beginning, when I first started, there were a lot of times that I questioned myself because I was one of very few. But then you grow and you have experiences and you start to feel more confident in yourself and you start to acknowledge that actually I am here because I've worked and I've got here because I did well. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, for sure. Because I think from my experience just recently is a lot of opportunity I've had in the last couple of years, also in Los Angeles, but with the tour has been, we really wanted to hire a magician, but we wanted something different. And then what ends up happening is they go, oh, that was good. Like, this is a quality act. So you might get opportunity because you're a woman, but also your act's good. So then you get more and more opportunity because of that.
I think the opportunities might come from being a woman. However, to stay in that position, you do need to be good. You know, no one can blag their way to the top and stay there if they don't have some kind of skill or talent behind them. So I think that's the thing. That's a very honest way of looking at it, that maybe some opportunities were given because of our gender, but we still had to work for them and we had to work hard to be able to keep them.
Yeah. Sometimes a lot of people will say, oh, Kayla, why are you going on and on with this podcast and this information about, like, oh, it's so hard to be a woman in magic. Well, it is in a lot of ways, but also I'm here. Like, there's been no excuse just because of the difficult things I've experienced or people like Connie Boyd have experienced in her career, which is totally different than I think what you and I might have, definitely what I've experienced is, it happened. My goal is to not let it continue to happen, but no excuse. I'm still here, still doing a show.
Exactly.
What are the positives and negatives or your experience specifically with magicians based off of your gender?
I mean, I've been really lucky in the sense that I've had a lot of support. I've really not had that many, if any, bad experiences. I get on genuinely quite well with people, which is nice. I've had more so with crew, that technicians struggle to sometimes take advice from me. And I think maybe that's a bit of a chauvinistic, you know, we are the men who do the work in the theater. But that's something that I've learned to deal with and to not get so frustrated with anymore. I used to get quite, you know, oh God, I want to punch you in the face. Whereas now I'm like, yeah, okay, whatever. However, I'm still telling you, change my lights. And then eventually they just do it. But I think that isn't necessarily magic. I think you find that in so many different industries. I've got friends who have worked their way up to the top in companies like Google and Apple, and they have their own stories of men struggling to listen to them whilst they work their way to the top. But you just got to keep going. And instead of getting angry about it, you just keep doing your thing.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I love it so much. Like, no excuses.
No, absolutely.
You just keep going.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing as well. Guys have struggles with things as well. You know, it's not like it's just women. There's always this kind of hierarchy in whatever industry you are in, whether it's Hollywood or whether you're working in the supermarket down the road. I think it's more apparent in magic because the industry is quite condensed anyway. It's not a large industry, so everything is quite obvious. But there are some really amazing female magicians, especially in the past 2 years. Like, it's happening. 4 or 5 years ago when I was doing these interviews, I was literally like the only female in magic. Whereas now there's so many great magicians. I don't know if you've seen Leah Kyle on Fooless. She did a quick change and she fooled them, and she is amazing. Like,
Cool.
I was just watching it, smiling from ear to ear. She's unbelievable. And I was like, that episode will change her life. Mm. She's going to continue to work now. There's another girl that I saw on AGT Champions, Diana someone. She was from Venezuela and she did a card trick. It was, oh, you have to look her up. She was, it was great. So nice. So their art is happening. It's not me sat here anymore saying, oh yeah, I'm the only female magician in the entire industry. Like, it's 3 years on and it's already changed so much. So it's exciting. It's going to even out pretty soon.
Yeah. Yay. Good. This is what I want. Great news. Let's dive in to the lightning round. The lightning round is meant to be just a fun way to end the episode. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. You can answer them as short as you would like, which is the definition of a lightning round, or you can max maven it and answer 2 hours per question.
Okay.
Are you ready?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Okay. What's your go-to magic resource?
YouTube. That's really bad, isn't it? But yeah.
Well, not if you already know what you're doing.
Inspiration-wise, YouTube. Not for actually figuring out how to do things. Normally friends. Ben Hart, a friend of mine. Do you know Ben? Okay.
So I worked the crew for a show Ben Hart did when he was 15.
No. What, in England?
No, it was in America. It was called the Stars of Tomorrow show. And it was a show that I did a couple of times. And then in off years when I wasn't in the show, I was doing the crew. My first show in it, I was 13 or 14. And then I think 2 years later, Ben was in it. Aww. And so I remember meeting him and he had a very like long fingers. And so we all just sort of.
They're probably longer now. They're like spider web.
They are. It's like, yeah, it's like he can reach really far. Yeah. It's amazing. So if you see him, he probably won't remember me, but please tell him I said hello.
I will. But yeah, he is my magic resource.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. What's your favorite illusion you've ever performed?
The soaring in half.
Which version?
Not the version with me in it, because that's painful. The version where I saw someone else in half, an audience member. I love that.
Great. Great. What's your least favorite illusion you've ever performed?
Oh, water torture cell. Ugh. Horrible. Horrible. You just can't relax. You start panicking at like midday about getting into it. It's just not an enjoyable one.
I mean, I'm upset for you. It sounds awful. What is a trick, illusion or not, that you'd like to perform and haven't yet?
I'd like to perform a levitation where, yeah, I've done a levitation with Hans, but I'd like to do a levitation just me and not one that anyone else has done before. Like, I really want to fly.
Yep. That is also my trick I would like to perform one day, but I don't have 60 grand to buy Copperfields.
Yeah, there you go. Neither do I, so we'll wait.
We'll go in on it together. And all I want to do is, I just want to play. You can perform it. I'll just play on it and it will be fine. That's all I want. Outside of tricks, what's your ultimate career goal in magic?
Ooh, my ultimate goal is to be on stage for as long as I physically can. That's my ultimate goal. Because ultimately, for me, that is what it is. It's performing. I just love to be on stage, whether you can be doing magic, you can be dancing, you can be acting, but just to be on stage and in the theater for me is the ultimate goal for as long as I can.
That's great. Big dogs or little dogs? You can
also... Big.
Thank you.
I didn't even think about it.
Good. You've answered correctly. Do you have a dog?
No, but if I was going to have a dog, it would be like this huge husky. I know this sounds awful and a lot of people will decide to dislike me after this, but I just think, what's the point in having like a small dog? Because you can just have like a cat or something. You know, dogs are like big and growling. They're like dangerous.
I can't agree with you more. Afterwards, I'll show you the Shazam's official mascot. He's downstairs sleeping.
Aww.
Yep. Everyone's like, yay, buddy. He's in many episodes by accident. So coffee or tea, and then how do you like to take it?
Coffee in the morning, black. And I like to have two of those. So I have one in the morning, one at lunch, and then from 12 o'clock onwards, tea.
If you could only have one dessert for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh, cheese. I love cheese.
What do you kind have of cheese
in America for like dessert? Is that like a thing or is that more of like a French thing?
I was hoping you would just ask if we have cheese in America.
No, I know we have cheese. But cheese is very different though to ours. It's not the same as like French cheese.
We do, but it's not the same as if you were to have a dinner in Paris or wine country in France or something. Yeah, cheese in America is often a sandwich thing. So you put some slices of cheese on a sandwich. But there is, if you go to a slightly more upscale kind of restaurant, you can get more dessert style cheese with fruit or...
Yeah, with some grapes and some chutney. Oh.
Yes. Oh, chutney. We also, Americans really love fondue, which I think is the worst thing in the world, but...
I had been to America before and someone gave me cheese in a tube and I was like, this is not cheese.
Was like it cheese string cheese?
No, it was like in a squeezy tube.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that is not cheese if it's in a tube.
No. Have you had string cheese?
I've had like the cheese string that you peel off. Yeah, I mean like cheese there.
Yeah, no, the actual cheese.
Love it.
Yeah, there's nothing like a good plate of dessert cheese. I really agree with you. And I didn't discover that until I traveled France.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I was like, oh yeah, this is how cheese should be. No, I want it. I'm vegan, so that will be problematic, but I'm going to think about it. No, it's good. Actually, there's some fantastic vegan cheeses that are perfect for dessert. Yeah.
Oh, good.
Whenever we meet in person, I will prepare you a vegan cheese. It'll be great. Yes. And then the last lightning round question. I forgot we were recording and not just hanging out and talking about cheese. Last question is, can you shout out a woman within magic that's doing great things that everyone should go check out?
Yeah. I say that like, yeah, but I'm thinking because there's actually quite a few, but I think Leah Kyle, who was on Flawless recently, I think she's going to be the next best thing.
Fantastic.
And her boyfriend, Florian Sainville, I think I'm totally saying their names wrong. They're French, but he does magic. He's in The Illusionist. And I think he has been a huge support for her. And I think he is really helping her come up with amazing ideas. So the two of them are a bit of a powerhouse couple when it comes to magic. So I think she's going to be doing great things.
That's awesome. Fantastic. Thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Yay. You're welcome. It's nice to finally chat.
You as well. And that's the episode. Don't forget to follow us on the socials at SheZamPod. For all things swag, head over to our website at shezampod.com for shirts, pins, and that coveted Don't Touch Me skateboard. You know you need it. If you are interested in the bonus content for this episode and future episodes, plus exclusive swag designs, behind-the-scenes content, and shout-outs in episodes, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/shezampod. Links to everything are in our show notes. You can also sponsor one of our many segments this season. I still have some spots left, so please email me at shezampod@gmail.com if you'd like to find out more. Shazam is sponsored in part by the International Brotherhood of Magicians and the Society of American Magicians. Thank you to the IBM and the SAM for your support. Our audio producer is Chris Combs. The Shazam theme song is recorded and produced by Kevin Karikas with vocals by Jonah Fagel. Thank you so much for listening, and we will see you soon. Bye.